If you will be opening in your Bibles, please, to Judges chapter 18. That's where our class will begin this evening. Thank you for being here. I'm looking forward to our class and discussion this evening on Judges chapter 18 and then through most of chapter 19. If you've already read ahead, you notice I'm stopping at a very strategic point in chapter 19 and reserving that for next week. You may remember if you were here last week that in last week's class, we finished the second part of Judges, which covers chapters 13 through 16 and encompasses the tales of the various judges, the last being Samson. And so we talked about his efforts against the Philistines and ultimately him dying in Gaza and killing many Philistines in his death as well by destroying the temple or the house that they were in. And then at beginning part three, the final part of Judges, which is the last five chapters, we discussed the religious corruption of a household, that being the household of Micah. You remember that he had stolen the silver pieces from his mother. She had pronounced a curse. He gave them back to her. Then she pronounced a blessing on him. And those silver pieces, or some portion of them, were used to construct idols. And those idols will come into play in our reading tonight in chapter 18. So not only was Micah's household corrupted, but a Levite was corrupted as well, because you remember that originally Micah, an Ephraimite, had made his own son a priest. And then when a sojourning Levite came to his house, Micah saw an opportunity to lend more credibility to his religious establishment that he was constructing, his self-made religion, and made this young Levite the priest to his house. And that Levite will also play a role in tonight's reading as well. We're going to continue on now with part three and discuss in chapter 18 the religious corruption of a tribe. And so that is the tribe of Dan. You remember that these last five chapters in Judges really just talk about two different tales. The first one that we're talking about now focuses on the religious corruption of these various groups and people. And then what we'll transition to in chapter 19 is moral and social corruption on a level almost unrivaled in the biblical narrative. And that's what we'll begin to talk about tonight with the events happening surrounding the Levite and his concubine in the town of Gibeah. With that said, let's go ahead and dive in. So after detailing the religious corruption of a household, that being Micah's, and of the Levite, the author is now going to turn to describing the religious corruption of the tribe of Dan. For reference, the author of Judges reminds us in chapter 18 and verse 1 that at this time in history of Israel, there was no king. You remember a point that I wanted to make last week but didn't, so I'll make it now, is that the only divine commentary on the events in the last chapter, in chapter 17 that we read, was this: everyone did what was right in his own eyes, chapter 17 and verse 5. And so all that they were doing in efforts of idolatry and self-made religion, setting up this shrine, establishing an Ephraimite as priest and then a Levite being a priest to a household, which was all aberrant behavior from what we had read about in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, all we have to go on is that phrase: everyone was doing what was right in his own eyes. We have to go elsewhere in Judges and also in the Old Testament to determine exactly what these characters had done wrong, and that's going to be the case for much of the remaining text. So as we move through the events, especially in chapter 18, especially toward the end of chapter 18, where the awful events take place around the Levite's concubine in Gibeah, there's no divine commentary, but remember, that's just fitting with this theme throughout the end of Judges, which is everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So now the narrative is going to focus on the Danites, the tribe of the Danites. And have y'all seen this before? It's been about a month, so I thought I'd flash it back up here again. So remember, this image describes where each tribe was allotted territory in the land of Canaan, and then based on the narrative all the way back in Judges chapter 1, what they were actually willing and successful in conquering. And so you see Dan here was allotted territory between Judah and Ephraim. However, you'll notice that most of Dan was left unconquered. Not that they weren't allotted territory, but they didn't conquer the territory as God had directed them. And that accounts for there being Dan 1 on this map and also Dan 2. And so we're going to read about that occasion, why there comes to be these different places associated with Dan on the map. So they seek a place to settle for, as it says in verse 1, no inheritance among the tribes of Israel had fallen to them. Again, that's not because they weren't allotted territories, because they hadn't conquered the territory that they were allotted. This plot of land that they're allotted is described in Joshua chapter 19. But as I said, as chapter 1 of Judges detailed, they had been unsuccessful in conquering that land due to the Amorites. And that may have included, according to some authors that I read, the Philistines, who you remember were major players down here. And you'll remember the Philistines were affecting and bothering the Danites, the Judites, and all of these down here in the south toward the plain. So the land had, again, not been captured by the Danites, not that it had been allotted to them. And that left them with, apparently, two small slivers of land that they were actually inhabiting here and there, although, of course, that was subject to change. So based on that, they're unsatisfied with the land that they have left. They're unwilling to conquer the land that God had allotted to them, and so they're looking out for someplace else to inhabit. Therefore, five men from the tribe of Dan are selected to spy out the land and explore it, and they depart from Zorah and Eshtaol. Where have we heard those two city names before? Wyatt?
Chapter 14?
That sounds right. Yep. A previous chapter in Judges concerning what character? Samson, that's right. So remember, Samson was a judge from the tribe of Dan. And so now we're seeing some connection that these spies are setting out from Zorah and Eshtaol. And after some time, whose house do they arrive at? Well, the individual we had read about in the previous chapter, that being Micah. And when they arrive at Micah's house, where the shrine is and the idols, they recognize the voice or the accent of one individual in particular, and that was that of the young Levite. And they kind of pepper him with questions in verse 4. They ask him how he came to be there, and he tells them he had been hired by Micah to be his priest, or to that of his household. So on this occasion, again, when they're just spying out the land, finding another replacement for the land that they had been allotted, they request that the Levite inquire of God whether their mission would be successful. The NET translates verse 5 in this way. They said to him, the Levite, seek a divine oracle for us so we can know if we'll be successful on our mission. Remember, they had rejected. They had rejected and abandoned their inheritance from God. And now they're asking a supposed priest of God if they would be blessed in their endeavor to find a replacement that's easier for them to conquer, because they were unwilling to conquer the land that they had been allotted. So I think it goes without saying that this was not endorsed by God and they would not be successful in the way that they thought they would be. In verse 6, the priest responds to them by saying, go in peace. The journey on which you go is under the eye of the Lord. And I couldn't help but think, I don't mean anything derogatory against politicians, but that this was like a politician's response. It's like very ambiguous. He's just telling them, go in peace. It's under the eye of the Lord. Well, of course it's under the eye of the Lord. Everything is under the eye of the Lord. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Lord is endorsing their journey. No indication that the priest did or was able to inquire of the Lord, especially with all of the idolatry that surrounded him in his current state. So they set out again. They're leaving Zorah and Eshtaol. They're going to travel up northward to a town called Laish. And actually, this event of the Danites conquering another city is recorded in Joshua chapter 19, all the way back in Joshua chapter 19, except there, the city's called Leshem, if I'm saying it right. And so you may remember all the way back to one of our first classes, we talked about a figure of speech called prolepsis, where an event is spoken of that has not yet happened, but as having happened. And so where in the whole timeline of Joshua and Judges these events actually took place is unclear, although it's possible that this endeavor by the Danites taking over Laish took place after the events of chapters 1 and 2, so before the time of many of the judges, Samson included. So what did they find when they came to Laish? It was peaceful and quiet, kind of like y'all this evening. It was peaceful and quiet, and they also noted that they were prosperous. And then there's a mention of Sidon, and so apparently there was some association between the people living in Laish and the Sidonians. I don't know exactly what that relationship was, but it also notes that they were separated from them so much that they didn't have any interactions with anybody else, and that's going to be to their disadvantage later in the chapter when the Danites bring their armed forces with them to conquer the city. This is pretty cool. So this is a record of a Pharaoh's Canaan campaign from about 1500 BC, which would have preceded the events of Judges chapter 18 by a couple hundred years. But that apparently says Laish, which just is neat that that city that eventually is renamed Dan, as we'll come to see, is recorded even in Egyptian history. So they observe the inhabitants are living in security and in wealth. And this site being Dan, as it's renamed, also again, formerly Laish, is associated with Sidon. And there's a New Testament parallel too, because you remember that in the New Testament, Sidon is mentioned very commonly with another city as a pair, that being Tyre. Very good. So Tyre and Sidon are frequently mentioned. It was in that region that Jesus encountered a Canaanite woman whose daughter was demon-possessed and eventually healed her daughter of that demon possession after an exchange. And so this site, Dan, or formerly Laish, marks the northern limit of Israel in many biblical passages. And there's a phrase in the Old Testament, from Dan to Beersheba, as we'll encounter in a few chapters, that's a common one in the Old Testament intended to encompass the entire land of Israel. And so Sidon, associated somehow with Laish, was a wealthy and powerful Phoenician city, as you can see, located on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And the distance between these two places is about 27 miles as the crow flies. And it's unclear to me, and I'd like if y'all have a strong opinion one way or another on this, whether the inhabitants of Laish, eventually called Dan, that the Danites conquer and defeat are foreigners or if they're Israelites. That's unclear to me from the text. It seems like the author indicates that since there's some relationship with Sidon, which I don't think was under Israelite control at this time, that they're foreigners and not Israelites. But it seems to me at least possible that Israelites were inhabiting Laish at this time. Does anybody have a thought one way or another on that? The only reason why I ask is because back in Deuteronomy 20, God had given direction on when the Israelites would go into battle against a city very far from them, and his direction there was when they came to that city, they would first offer it terms of peace. And if the offer of peace was rejected, then they could kill, I think, only the males in that city. But here we're seeing the Danites don't follow any direction of any sort like that, as far as we're able to see from Deuteronomy chapter 20, which would have applied to foreigners and, of course, not to Israelites. So anyway, just a thought for your own consideration. So the spies make it all the way up to Laish, which they'll eventually rename Dan, and they come back to their brethren in Zor and Eshtaol and report on the prospect of conquering the city for their inheritance. They're excited about it. They insist on attacking the people and encourage their brethren to invade and conquer the land. The NET translates verse 9 in this way: "Come on, let's attack them, for we saw their land and it is very good. You seem lethargic, but don't hesitate to invade and conquer the land." So they even go so far as to say, God is handing it over to you, maybe informed by their message from the supposed priest in Micah's house, that their journey was under the eye of the Lord. But remember, they had refused to fully conquer their original inheritance from God. So based on this report, 600 men depart from the territory remaining in Dan, Zor, and Eshtaol, and they first camp in Judah, and then eventually pass on to the hill country of Ephraim, where they again come to Micah's house. I think I skipped ahead a slide, so I'll pause there for just a second. That brings us down through verse 13. Does anybody have a question or comment before we go on? All right. So these are five original spies back at Micah's house, but with armed reinforcement. inform their brethren of the idolatrous shrine and the contents in Micah's house, they say, now therefore consider what you will do, based on the information that they had been given. So we're telling you about these idols and the shrine that's here in Micah's house. Consider what you might do. So the 600 armed men stand as guard outside the entrance of the gate of Micah's house, while the five original spies ask the young Levite about his welfare. In this process, they take all the items in the shrine, including the idols Micah's mother had made at the beginning of the previous chapter, while the priest stood by the entrance of the gate, of course, helpless against this force. So it's just helpful, and this may be an unnecessary comment for you, but to remember that there was no calling 911 back in these days. There was no police. And so if a mightier force or people came in and wanted to steal something from you, there was nothing to prevent that from happening. And that's what takes place here, and that's what's going to take place in Gibeah, where there's just atrocities galore happening, and there's no order. There's no king. There's no king, and there's no rule of law. Everyone was doing right in their own eyes. One person I read made an interesting connection that their plundering of another tribe fulfills Jacob's prediction back in Genesis chapter 49 that Dan would deal viciously with others like a serpent or a viper. So the priest then asks them what they're doing. You think maybe he's concerned about them stealing things, but I think really he's just concerned about the idols that they're taking that he thought were being used to facilitate his worship to God. And then he's offered a position of father or advisor and priest to the tribe of Dan, which was the same offer that Micah had made to him in the previous chapter. Be to us a father and a priest. And they reason with him and say, isn't it better for you to be a father and priest to an entire tribe than just to someone's house? So in the young Levite's eyes, this is a big promotion. And he agrees. He abandons Micah's house to serve the Danites. Remember in the previous chapter when it said that Micah regarded this young man as a son? Now he's being betrayed by that Levite since he's going off with the Danites. So his allegiance, of course, is not to God or even to Micah, but to his own ego and ambition. In fact, so strong is their language, the Danites' language, back to him that the NET translates verse 19 in this way. They said to him, shut up, put your hand over your mouth and come with us. You can be our advisor and priest. Wouldn't it be better to be a priest for a whole Israelite tribe than for just one man's family? Coincidentally, in my Bible reading this week, there was another occasion in Genesis in which household items were taken from someone's house. Does that ring any bells for anybody? If I didn't write it down, I wouldn't remember the names because I get the Isaacs and Jacobs and everybody mixed up. But does anybody remember off the top of your head? Yeah, that's right. Oh, you are. Great memory. So Rachel took the idols from her father's, Laban's, house when they parted ways in Genesis chapter 31. All right, that brings us down through verse 20. This is Dan as it appears today. And so as if you were doing a really good job listening to David's lesson on Sunday morning, he mentioned Dan, in relation to the high place that Jeroboam set up here a few hundred years after the events here in Judges. But what we're seeing here is really a precursor to that event. It's kind of the seed of the more extreme steps that Jeroboam took at that place. So much has been done in the intervening time. So this just describes the Danites' migration. So they start down here in Zorah Eshtaol. They meet up with Micah here, take his priests and his household shrine and idols, and they make their way up to Laish and conquer the land up there. Okay, I'm way behind. All right, so then this is just a rendition of them removing from Micah's house all the items that they had taken. And then we'll get to this in a little bit. So the fighting men of Dan leave Micah's house with these items and with his Levite priest. Strategically, they put the children, livestock, and goods in front of them, anticipating some sort of attack from behind, from Micah or his cohorts. Sure enough, Micah and his neighbors muster a force, and they overtake the people of Dan. First, Micah and his neighbors shout at the Danites to get their attention, and in turn, the Danites ask Micah, what is the matter with you that you come with such a company? Micah responds by saying and noting that they had robbed him of his goods and his priests, leaving him with nothing, and go so far as to have the audacity to ask, "What is the matter with you?" How then do the Danites respond in verse 25? Yeah, that's right. "Be quiet or we'll kill you. Don't say another word to us or some very angry men will attack you and you or your family will die," which is pretty passive-aggressive language because they were the very angry men they were talking about here. But that's a threat, and Micah takes it seriously. He's unable to defeat this force and returns to his house in defeat. Turn back to chapter 17 and read verse 13. Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest." Did that turn out to be true for him? No, of course not. Make the point again. He was attempting self-made religion then. It didn't turn out well for him then, and doesn't turn out well for the Danites either, and especially with events that take place in the future in this city that they overtake. That brings us down to verse 26. So I'll pause here again and see if anybody has a question or comment.
Verse 34, "Then the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, wouldn't let them down in the valley." This mess started back then. And why were the Danites angry? They never got their allotment. They never had their home. They never had their life. They never had what they thought was due them. So they decided to take it. It's an interesting commentary that they went that way after they allowed themselves to not do what they were commanded to do in order to have that inheritance. There's a lesson in there for us as well. We think something's due us, but have we done the things that God put in front of us to do? It's a question that we ought to ask.
Good point.
It wouldn't have been easy for them to have conquered the land, for the Danites or any other tribe, but God had endorsed it. He had put his full weight of support behind it, so they should have known it was possible, but they were unwilling to overcome that difficulty and take possession of what God gave them, and instead wanted something that they could more easily conquer, which is 600 fighting men, which they do successfully. All right, anything else before we pick up in verse 27? All right, so now with this fighting force, they arrive at Laish to these people, quiet and unsuspecting, and kill the people there and burn the city. The Danites rebuild the city and named it after Dan, their ancestor, who was, as you'll remember, the son of Jacob and Rachel's handmaid, Bilhah, which we know from Genesis chapter 30. There they set up the carved images from Micah's house, and the young Levite, whose name we finally know, which is Jonathan, serves as their priest. It's also noted that his descendants served as priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of the captivity of the land. So a couple things. First of all, this priest has remained nameless up until this point, and now he's finally introduced as Jonathan, and at least in the ESV and some other translation is called a descendant of Moses, so son of Gershom, son of Moses. So Gershom was Moses' firstborn son. Now, whether Jonathan was a son of Gershom or just a descendant, I don't know for sure, but he was related to Moses. And it's thought that for that reason, some scribes were uncomfortable with this association with Moses and so made a slight change to say that he was the son of Manasseh. So some versions say son of Manasseh instead of son of Moses. I don't, have a dog in that fight. I don't know which one is exactly right. Moses was not from the tribe of Manasseh. He was a Levite himself, and so was Gershom, and so was Jonathan. But nevertheless, that accounts for what you may see in this chapter as the difference there between, or a footnote that you see there as well. Further, the note that it occurred until the day of captivity in the land probably refers to the Assyrian captivity, which took place in the 8th century BC, so a couple hundred years after The events here in Judges, when the 10 northern tribes of Israel were exiled because of their relentless unfaithfulness to God. So as a note, the tabernacle at this time was in Shiloh first. Laish Dan, further, was not one of the cities allotted to the Levites. So Jonathan and his descendants, as far as my study goes, had no business setting up shop in Dan, much less facilitating idolatrous worship with the carved images brought from Micah's house. And so here you can see a complex which has been excavated. This is from the time of Jeroboam, which, again, David mentioned in his Sunday morning class from 1 Kings chapter 12, when Jeroboam was afraid that if his, people, returned to Jerusalem, they would be loyal to Jeroboam. So he took counsel in verse 28 and made two calves of gold, and he put one of them in Dan. That's the very place we're reading about now, formerly called Laish. Interestingly, in verse 31, it also says that Jeroboam made temples on high places and did something else, appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. But of course, that wasn't new to Jeroboam. We've seen that already in the book of Judges. And so to emphasize David's point from Sunday morning, wisdom fails. That is to say, human wisdom fails. What Jeroboam did in 1 Kings 12, which had its seeds in the Danites' actions here in Judges chapter 18, that was all human wisdom, and it failed. And it just led to more and more unfaithfulness over time. And this Levite, who had humble beginnings just as a sojourner, but saw an opportunity first to be of more prestige in Micah's house, and then of even more prestige as a priest of the tribe of Danite, the Danites, serves as a warning to leaders or people in positions of authority in all eras of history. By compromising his calling and accepting that handsome support of Micah, he only goes on to abandon Micah when the offer from the tribe of Dan was put on the table, and that ultimately affected not only a household or a tribe, but an entire nation as well. Again, laying the groundwork for their unfaithfulness here in 1 Kings chapter 12, which was the reason why God handed them over to the Assyrians in the north. So that brings us in to the end of chapter 18. And so before we pick up in chapter 19, what questions or comments do y'all have? All right then, so having finished that first account, which encompassed chapters 17 and 18 and described religious corruption in Israel, now we're going to move on to the last three chapters in Judges, which really all are the same, not the same event, but all associated around the same event. Again, an event with small beginnings, but one that quickly escalates into what ends up being a civil war in Israel. And like I made the point several times, it's just part of the overall narrative of Judges, which is that downward spiral that the author is trying to communicate of the result of this continued unfaithfulness to God. So having completed that first account, the author now moves on to the second account, which again starts on a small scale but escalates into a nationwide civil war. This account also begins with or involves a Levite. This time, this Levite is from the Ephraimite hill country. And we learned that, so that's here, Ephraimite hill country, and then Gibeah here in the tribe of Benjamin is where the terrible events later in this chapter are going to take place and where the battle is going to take place in the next chapter, in chapter 20. So that's all depicted here on the map. So this Levite's concubine was unfaithful to him, or some translations say was angry with him, and as a result, left to return to her father's house in Bethlehem, which is here at the bottom of the map. So after 4 months, the Levite, again, this is a different one than we read about in the previous chapters, he wants to make amends. In verse 3, it actually says he intends to speak kindly to her and travels to Bethlehem to convince her to return. When he arrived at his destination, the girl's father greeted him warmly. By the way, we're not going to talk about it tonight, but in verse 3, where it says his intention was to speak kindly to her, as you read through the rest of this chapter, just mark the only time that his words to his concubine are actually recorded. and what he said to her. But again, that's for next week's class. So this was his intention in returning to Bethlehem. But as far as the record goes, the only thing he ever said to her was absolutely callous and detestable. So the reason for this concubine's return home is uncertain. The word that's used here is only used here in the Old Testament. And again, either means that she became angry or she despised him. And so many translations in English either say she was unfaithful to him or played the harlot, or that it was that she just became angry. At any rate, she returned home, and the Levite eventually followed her there. Some suggested that, like we read about in Deuteronomy chapter 22, laws concerning sexual immorality, that an accusation had been made against her that she was not actually a virgin when she married the Levite, which would have been a problem for him, especially because he was a Levite, considering what Leviticus 21, 14, and 15 say. I can't prove that for a fact from what it says here. It just says either that she was unfaithful to him or that she was angry with him and she returned home. So now the Levite comes to his father-in-law's house, for lack of a better term, and what follows in the next six verses to the modern reader is unfamiliar to us. Like when we go over to someone's house and stay with them, you know, the person who goes is usually the one that decides, all right, we're leaving, we're going back home now. But in this culture, it was the father-in-law that insisted that he stay longer and longer. And so there's this elaborate exchange day after day where the Levite initially wanted to leave after just 3 days, but his father-in-law kept insisting he stay longer. And so it seems like on the fifth day, after the girl's father tries to persuade them to stay another day and leave in the morning, that's when the Levite says, no, we're just going to go ahead and leave today. Apparently, there were several hours of daylight left because the narrative says that the sun set as they reached Gibeah. But the timing of this exchange on that last day is crucial because by the time they make it to Gibeah and the sun is setting, it's going to set up the scene for what follows in Gibeah there later in the chapter. So this depicts the journey that they're going to make back to the Levite's home. So they started out in Bethlehem, and as we'll see in just a moment, they were taking this northerly road. And at first, the servant who accompanied the Levite suggested that they stop in Jebus, which, again, understanding the time, was Jerusalem, but not yet fully in Israelite control. That didn't happen until King David's reign. So it was a city of the Jebusites at this time, and the Levite reasons, I don't want to stay in a city of foreigners tonight, so let's go on. And so they intend to go on either to Gibeah or to Ramah, and again, they arrive in Gibeah about sunset. So that all started because Levite refused his father-in-law's invitation to stay another night. They set out. The servant again recommended that they stay in Jebus, and it's unknown, of course, what might have happened had they stayed in the city of the Jebusites. But it's hard to imagine anything worse happening there than what ends up happening in Gibeah. Again, that's just my speculation, but can't change what actually ended up happening in the story. So they make their way, and in stark contrast upon arriving in Gibeah to the hospitality that he had received in Bethlehem at his father's house, the Levite, his servant, and concubine are forced to sit in the town square, for no one took them into the house to spend the night. And so already we're seeing trouble brewing as there's a blatant disregard for sojourners in Gibeah. And again, this is an Israelite city. These are Israelites living in this city. So the distance between Jebus or Jerusalem and Gibeah is about 2 miles. Sorry. So at a brisk walking pace, this would have placed Gibeah about an hour further along the path from the point where the Levite and his travel companions passed by Jebus. And so they would have walked from Bethlehem, and then if they were walking along this ridge, would have had a view of Jebus, which this is modern-day Jerusalem. That's the Temple Mount today there. You can barely see. But they end up deciding to go over here to Gibeah. So briefly, Gibeah is a significant city in the Old Testament because it's connected with several faithful priests who served God and took a stand against sin. The last verse in the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 24 and verse 33, says there, Eleazar the son of Aaron died, and they buried him at Gibeah. the town of Phinehas, his son, which had been given him in the hill country of Ephraim. So here we have Aaron, the brother of Moses, his son Eleazar, who's buried in Gibeah here, which is the town of Phinehas, his son. So Phinehas is Aaron's grandson. So Eleazar, Aaron's son, brothers were Nadab and Abihu, of Nadab and Abihu infamy. And Phinehas, Eleazar's son and Aaron's grandson, you remember what event he stands out in the history of Israel for? What he did that stopped God's anger after the Israelites were worshiping Baal and Peor? That's right. So there was a man, an Israelite man, and a Moabite woman committing fornication in plain day, and he ran him through with a spear. That's Phinehas. So that's the history of Gibeah. At least I know a place doesn't retain, you know, the character of the people who are buried there or live there, but you can just see by this time how much things have degraded. And Gibeah is the hometown of King Saul. And part of the narrative, I think, in Judges of the contrast between Saul's leadership and David's leadership as king. So that brings us down through verse 15. We're only going down through verse 21, so I'll pause here and see if someone has a question or comment before we move on. All right, picking up in verse 16. While waiting in the town square, an Ephraimite, remember, what tribe are we in? Gibeah's in the tribe of Benjamin, okay? Gibeah's in Benjamin. There's an Ephraimite sojourning here in Gibeah. An old man, we're told. He's coming in from his work in the field. He sees the travelers in the square, asks about their journey, where they're from, and where they're going. The Levite responds by telling the old man about their journey, lets him know they hadn't been welcomed into anyone's home up to this point. Notably, the Levite fails to mention why he had embarked on the journey in the first place. That's not part of what he tells the Ephraimite old man here in Gibeah. And by the way, when you read in verse, in chapter 20 for next week's class, when this Levite recounts to the Israelite assembly, just notice in his recounting of the events that take place in Gibeah, how his story differs from what actually happened. We'll highlight some of those differences, hopefully, next week. So the Levite further assures the old man they have enough provisions for themselves and for their animals. Just listen to Leviticus chapter 19, verse 33. When a stranger sojourns within your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So again, that's the first big red flag here, is their disregard for the sojourning Israelites here in the land. But Gibeah's crime does not end with a lack of hospitality. The old Ephraimite responds by saying, "Peace be to you," or the NET says, "Everything is just fine." He then invites them into his house, asking them not to spend the night in the town square. The travelers go to the old man's house, wash their feet, and share a meal. What ensues, which we'll plan to discuss next week, is a uniquely grotesque event in the biblical narrative, and as I mentioned before, will lead to civil war in chapter 20. That brings us to the end of the verses we're going to read for tonight. So I'll pause here again and see if anybody has a concluding comment or question. Yes, ma'am.
Just even going through verse 22, it makes you think about Sodom and Lot and what occurred there with the angels that visited.
Yes, that's right. Great point. And so as you read the verses for next week, do contrast them with what happened in Sodom and Gomorrah with Lot and the angelic messengers who went there. It's a mirror. It's a mirror story to the one that takes place here. But I would contend that what happens here is worse, because they actually follow through with what they intended to do with this poor young girl. What else? Yes.
It's when I hear the phrase in Judges, everyone did what was right in his own eyes, my mind kind of translates that to they did whatever they wanted, or they did what they wanted, or they did lots of things that were wrong that were not right in God's eyes. But to think that all of this crazy stuff, all the choices that they made, were right to them is shocking. It would almost not be, it'd still be just as big a deal if they knew they were wrong, but just wanted to do it, so they went with it anyway. That'd be one thing. But they were so ignorant and unaware of God's will that they thought they were, if I understand that phrase correctly, they thought they were doing right. So that's fine. Just, also just reminds me of kids, just to whatever pops in their head.
Yeah. That's so true. That's a great segue then into our takeaway, which I'll just go over quickly. This goes back to the first account of Micah, Levite, and the Danite affair. And it's that idolatry was so endemic, it was so prevalent at this time in Israelite life that they were unable and unwilling to recognize it and to root it out of their culture. Furthermore, as J.D. pointed out well, they actually thought it was right. They thought it was a good thing to do. The danger for us is that we can be similarly blinded if we're not careful. By struggling with idolatry and even self-made religion, when we lack the desire to carefully study the Bible, and even, and I'm not trying to be controversial here, but respectfully question long-held conclusions and practices that we've been a part of. Because that's a lot of what was lacking in Judges, and a lot of what lacks in the history of Israel, even after Judges, is questioning their practices compared to God's law that he had given them. And that's the purpose of our class. One of the purposes of it is to prevent us from stumbling into the same trap that the Israelites fell into. And we will fall into it if we make the same mistake they did, which is being blinded to the reality of the situation that we're in and not comparing our lives carefully against the standard of God's word. So thank y'all very much.